from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up this morning in our opening hour of Forum, Iran's president told the United Nations General Assembly that his country is under threat from uncivilized Zionists and urged other leaders to confront the power centers that he said dominated weaker countries. In a speech, Ahmadinejad demanded that the United Nations restructure itself to give equal say to all countries. And the United Nations has, of course, imposed economic sanctions on Iran for its nuclear program, and President Obama, also addressing the United Nations, said the United States will, quote, do what we must to keep Iran from getting nuclear arms. We talked to Hoover Institution fellow Abraham Sofer about the recent developments and his new book called Taking on Iran. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Abraham Sofer joins us for this opening hour of Forum. He's author of a new book called Taking on Iran, Strength, Diplomacy, and the Iranian Threat. And he'll join us for this opening hour. He's senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he's also the George Shultz Distinguished Scholar, and he's former legal advisor to the State Department and former U.S. District Judge in New York State. The book is called The Best Defense. His last book was called The Best Defense, Legitimacy and Preventive Force. And protests took place just yesterday, as many of you know, in New York City. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad presented his eighth and final address to the General Assembly of the United Nations at the annual gathering there of world leaders.
Policies of the world's main centers of power are based on the principle of domination and the conquering of others. These centers only seek supremacy and are not in favor of peace and definitely not at the service of their nation.
That speech that was delivered, as I said yesterday, to the General Assembly was not attended by the United States, Canada, or Israel. The Muslim Republic's chief executive criticized U.S. global dominance, called for a new world order, and a restructuring of the United Nations, as well as denouncing what he characterized as, quote, uncivilized Zionists, end of quote. And he declared that Iran can neutralize any attempt at sabotaging its nuclear facilities. Abraham Sofer, author of Taking on Iran, Strength, Diplomacy, and the Iranian Threat, is with us in studio this morning. And Abe, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, the speech, should he have been allowed to speak? I mean, we just talked to Salman Rushdie, who said free speech under any circumstances, but there are many people who are saying he shouldn't have been invited in the first place. Your take?
Well, I was one of the people who said that. I'm as a former legal advisor, I know how important it is that we abide by the UN agreement that we allow everyone, all state leaders, to come in and speak. And of course, he can speak anywhere. It isn't as though he has to speak in New York. But I felt, and I agreed with my colleague Erwin Cutler from Canada, that he really has individually committed an international crime by inciting genocide. So he fit into a very narrow category that we put Arafat in, and the former Secretary General who was found to have kept secret his Nazi affiliations,
Kurt Waldheim.
I felt that he does fall into that category and should not have been allowed to speak. But
this has been all this controversy about Farsi being interpreted as saying that Israel should be destroyed or we will destroy Israel, when he perhaps, according to some, just said it will go away, it will disappear, it will somehow no longer exist.
Well, Jews are cockroaches. And I mean, there have been, his speech yesterday was mild compared to some of the other statements that he's made. And having missiles go down the road, go down the street in Tehran with signs on them saying, destroy Israel, after all that rhetoric, I think it is incitement of genocide.
Well, do you think that the United States is taking the right tack here? In fact, let's actually hear what President Obama had to say about this.
Make no mistake, a nuclear-armed Iran is not a challenge that can be contained. It would threaten the elimination of Israel, the security of Gulf nations, and the stability of the global economy. It risks triggering a nuclear arms race in the region and the unraveling of the non-proliferation treaty. That's why a coalition of countries is holding the Iranian government accountable. And that's why the United States will do what we must to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Well, that was President Obama talking about obviously trying to avert a nuclear weapon or Iran developing a nuclear weapon. He's also said that diplomacy and sanctions are the way to do whatever it's going to take to make sure, with time limited, that that nuclear weaponry is not part of Iran's arsenal. And is the president taking the right tack here, Abe Sofer?
To the extent he goes, yes. I think the president is saying the right things, but I think having the option of economic sanctions on the one hand to try to get Iran to stop its programs, and on the other hand, an all-out war, which would have to be to destroy Iran's nuclear program, which I think would have enormously negative consequences, even if it were successful, which I don't think it will be. I mean, most experts believe once a country has the ability to develop a nuclear weapon, they don't lose that ability. They would have to go underground. They would renounce the treaty, the non-proliferation treaty. I mean, I think ultimately that kind of a thing might be required, but he knows, the president knows, and his national security team knows, the generals know, that it is just as an undesirable, probably, and a course to have a massive attack on Iran as it is to allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. And that's why I wrote my book, because I think that we have been missing an opportunity to be somewhat tougher with Iran, especially the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and at the same time have a much more robust diplomatic initiative with Iran. So, yes, I think the president certainly is right in what he says about the consequences of a nuclear-armed Iran, but I think more could be done to show Iran we really are serious and to avoid this almost fatalistic feeling that we have in the world today that we're either going to have a war with Iran or Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon. And I just think it's a very unhealthy course.
Well, I want to talk with you, of course, about what you outline in your book as a way of perhaps being tougher with Iran, or specifically the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But you also point out in the book that there is no precedent, I mean, international precedent for preventive action of this sort, which would mean taking out, I mean, the Israelis bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor. They also probably took out the Syrian nuclear reactor. But to stop a possible war, I mean, China developed nuclear weapons, Pakistan, as you point out, North Korea, Libya, for that matter, the Soviet Union, no preventive taking out.
Well, and it wasn't just a happenstance. There were very concrete proposals made to the president, Presidents Eisenhower, Truman, and Johnson, that action should be taken to prevent the Soviet Union, China, from having nuclear weapons. And guarantees were made to the president by our military people that they really could take out this nuclear program in these two countries. And there was a lot of fear generated around that issue, that why let the Soviets have nuclear weapons? Why let the Chinese? You remember the Yellow Menace, et cetera? I was in high school then. It was terrifying. But you know, I think sort of Truman summed it up when he said a U.S. policy is that we don't make a war in order to prevent a possible war. And that is ultimately where we have come out. Every time we've had to face this problem, we have convinced some countries not to get nuclear weapons. And that's the best outcome, where we can actually convince countries through some means lesser than an all-out war.
Those means may not work with Iran, though, of course.
They may not. But we don't know if all we're doing is threatening and imposing economic sanctions, which they're clearly willing to absorb. We will never find out, and the type of diplomacy we're doing with Iran is really amateurish. It's got nothing to do with real diplomacy, the kind of diplomacy the Reagan administration engaged in with the Soviet Union. And you know, in my book, I lay out these five practices that we have absolutely abandoned with regard to Iran. We do not treat Iran as a sovereign state in our relations with Iran.
One of the big ones that you lay out, and we're talking about means now again, is linkage.
Totally. Linkage was very deliberately and consciously broken by the president, Reagan. George Shultz made a very detailed presentation to the Congress saying, I'm not telling you, Congress, that the Soviets are nicer people than you think they are. They're terrible, terrible people. They're so terrible that if we link their conduct to our willingness to talk to them, we will never get to talk to them. And that's really the situation we are in with Iran. I'm not saying that Iran is a good country. Of course, it is a good country, but the IRGC is a truly evil force around the world.
Actually, you call it in your book, I believe, the world's most aggressive supporter of terrorism and more dangerous than al-Qaeda?
Oh, far more dangerous than al-Qaeda. They are in charge of the Iranian nuclear program and the Iranian missile program.
I thought the mullahs were in charge.
Well, the mullahs are really not in charge. The IRGC is in charge with the Grand Ayatollah.
And what you're talking about in terms of stronger measures with the IRGC, with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, has to do with – well, give us some – well, you do give some examples in your book. And those examples of – there's a contrast in your book between times when the United States did not act and perhaps should have acted with stronger measures where Iran was concerned and times when the United States did act. And that acted – to the benefit of diplomacy, tougher action, essentially.
Tougher action leads to more meaningful diplomacy. Everyone agrees with that. It's just that everyone's only talked about economic sanctions.
Or about the nuclear issue.
Right. And if we, you know, if we had an opponent here that was not attacking us, of course we wouldn't be talking about attacking them. I'm talking about 32 years of IRGC surrogate attacks through Hezbollah and other terrorist organization, and also direct attacks directly supporting the Sadrists in Iraq. I mean, when the full story is told of the extent to which Iran supported our enemies in Iraq and is now supporting our enemies in Afghanistan, it'll be a disgrace. It'll be a public disgrace that we did nothing about the IRGC. So I'm not talking about a situation where we are artificially ramping up the guns to put pressure on Iran to give up its nuclear program. This is – we have totally failed, other than the one instance you mentioned, the 86-87 naval operations in the Gulf. We have totally failed – to deal with IRGC surrogate and terrorist attacks against the United States, which have, my calculations indicate, they have killed roughly the same amount of U.S. soldiers as were killed, civilians were killed in 9/11.
How many, and in fact, you talk about 9/11 in your book, and you say essentially we're taking the same kind of police role with respect to Iran.
The law enforcement approach.
Law enforcement approach, as you call it. Which, in your mind, doesn't seem to be effectual. You're talking about tough action. But let's go back for a moment. I can hear some of my listeners thinking to themselves, well, this is the same guy that supported the Iraq War. Maybe that was a very costly war in terms of life and treasure. It's not worth the price, and maybe getting tougher on Iran is going to lead to something along those lines. We're going to get ourselves into a kind of situation we did with Iraq again.
Well, you know, humility is something that I've learned over and over again. I do and still believe that – I did believe and I still believe that we properly put an end to the Saddam Hussein regime. I never shared the view that various people in the Bush administration advanced that we should make a democracy out of Iraq and that Iraq would be a pushover. I've always taken the view that we should do everything we can to reduce the ability of our enemies to harm America and Americans. But that's it. Self-defense. We cannot afford to spend our entire wealth trying to reform countries that are not willing to accept our ideas.
But what are you thinking of when you're talking about tougher responses? I know, for example, though Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger gave you a nice blurb here, and so did former Secretary of State Shultz, as well as Abbas Milani, head of Iranian studies at Stanford. Secretary Kissinger had some concerns about what you mean by pushing back on Iran, and I mean, you talk, for example, about a whole different kind of statescraft now, what Kissinger was called, real politic. Right. So this means sending drones into Iran?
Absolutely. We definitely should send. I think the IRGC leadership is far more dangerous to the United States today than the al-Qaeda leadership or ever was. And we have restricted very deliberately and very artificially the, quote, war on terrorism. The administration doesn't like to use the word war. The fact is that whatever you call it, it's an armed conflict against people who use terrorist techniques. And the IRGC is the ultimate user of terrorist techniques against the United States.
But how do you hit them? Surrogates. I mean, we're hitting people with drones. We're killing innocent people with drones.
We should have, since 83, we should have been pushing back against the terrorist attacks on the Marine barracks in Lebanon. I've listed them all in a long chapter.
But pushing back now means
administration
what?
By administration, the failure of every administration, including Reagan, of course. We did everything wrong with Iran and everything right with the Soviet Union. And I was there. Yeah. It was the incongruity of our conduct.
And I remember President Reagan saying, you can't run, you can't hide and all that.
Yeah.
Not backed up. It was just rhetoric.
Totally rhetoric vis-a-vis Iran.
But what do you do now? I mean, if a Marine barracks, God forbid, a Marine barracks blows up again in Lebanon, does that mean we hit drones and innocent people die in Iran?
Well, absolutely not. We don't go after innocent people anywhere. However,
they're being killed in Afghanistan. They're being killed in Pakistan.
Let's talk about a concrete thing, recent, Michael. We have very strong evidence that the IRGC had a plot to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador in Washington, D.C. And there's recorded testimony, recorded evidence that they told the would-be killers that they didn't care if this was done with a bomb in a restaurant in downtown Washington. Lots of civilians would have been killed. Now, we know who those IRGC officials are. And, of course, if you look at the complaint that's been filed, a criminal complaint, that we file a criminal complaint against the IRGC officials that did this, and it doesn't name all of the ones we know, because if you have to go to the Treasury Department to find out that there were more higher-level IRGC officials that blessed this all the way up to the very top. And we learned with al-Qaeda that you cannot stop a terrorist organization from killing Americans with impunity by using criminal law exclusively. Of course, these are crimes.
Maybe you try to send assassins in, or you send drones in. I mean, there's a big difference between those two. There have been nuclear scientists in Iran who've been assassinated. And
I'm against that, incidentally. You do not assassinate a civil servant who is doing his job for his country.
Leader of IRGC?
That's a different thing entirely. This man is ordering terrorist attacks on Americans. He should be killed. He is killing Americans, many, many Americans. Incidentally, Soleimani is his name. He has killed many Americans in Iraq, American soldiers. He has helped set up situations where they've trapped American soldiers and killed them. He has given the Sadrs equipment that have penetrated our vehicles, our armored vehicles, and killed our children in those vehicles. This is not speculation. Every military leader of America has said this publicly, but we have done nothing. Now, I have said, with respect to Iraq, we should have been bombing those bases they have right alongside of the Iraqi border. We should have been bombing the convoys that were carrying the equipment to kill our soldiers. You lose your neutrality in a war if you join an enemy of the United States. You lose your neutrality. Everyone knows that. And we didn't do it. And the message that sends, Michael, is even more important than the need to do something, because the message sent by not doing something about a brutal attack that either was made or certainly was attempted in Washington, D.C., the message that's sent is there's a fundamental lack of credibility that results. And every word the president says, instead of being backed up with the moderate, lawful, disciplined uses of force that we are clearly entitled to against the IRGC is backed up with a record of non-action. And, you know, that together with all the rhetoric we had with North Korea is going to lead the Iranian leadership to conclude, I think has led the Iranian leadership to conclude, that we are a paper tiger. They use that phrase, paper tiger. Now,
they also use
they may be wrong. They may be wrong about Obama.
I also used the phrase yesterday that we're Satan again. I haven't heard that since Khomeini. We're talking, by the way, with Abraham Sofer, and his new book is out, and it is called Taking on Iran, Outlining a Strategy for Dealing with Iran, which you're hearing here. And by the way, we invite you to join us. In fact, you're cordially invited to join us now. Our toll-free number is available, so feel free to be a part of this conversation. That number is 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your calls, and you can call us now, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join the program, you can also email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going on our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment or go to our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but by all means, feel free to communicate with us your point of view and what you agree with or disagree with, or any questions or comments you might have. Of course, the real danger with getting tough on the IRGC, attacking their facilities or their assets, which is pretty much what you're saying.
Right. We
get into open conflict, and we get into real war again.
Yeah, and it's a very
and
limited
diplomacy
conflict.
Just goes out the window.
No, that's not so. That is certainly not so with Iran. The one time we did attack Iran in the Gulf, I was handling U.S.-Iranian diplomacy at the time. I was in charge of the negotiations.
The oil platforms were destroyed?
No. Yes, we destroyed, oil platforms. We sank half their navy. It was a very effective. They stopped mining the Gulf. First of all, their conduct changed completely. They stopped mining the Gulf. They stopped interfering with U.S.-flagged vessels, the Kuwaiti vessels we had flagged. And they asked me to come back to The Hague. Even though I had canceled my trip, they asked me to come back to The Hague to continue negotiating about the cases and other things that we were talking about in The Hague. And every time we've exercised strength, every time we've used strength, the Iranians have been more open to negotiating with the United States.
But you will concede this is, number one, different leadership under Khamenei, and number two, there's a possibility of open warfare, is there not?
There is a possibility of limited warfare which is two-sided instead of one-sided, Michael. Right now, there is open warfare. It's been going on since 83. They have been attacking us, and we have not been defending ourselves. Now, if you think that leads to peace, you're nuts. I mean, the history of mankind shows that when you don't do anything about a state that says it hates you, and they're attacking and killing your people, the biggest danger of all is not just that we won't deter them. Of course, deterring them is very, very important. But the biggest danger of all is that we lack credibility, and they will make a miscalculation about our president. And they will say to themselves, this is going to be another repeat of North Korea, where we said we are never going to let you have a nuclear weapon. And we ended up letting them have a nuclear weapon.
We're coming up on a break here. What do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu is going to say in response today? Any thoughts?
He's going to try to spell out a red line and a case for red lines. And, I think it shows how very important this is for Israel, but it's not the right strategy.
Very important for Israel, even though the polls are showing that they don't support a war with Iran?
Well, they don't support a unilateral Israeli strike, absolutely.
We'll hear from you when we return. Abraham Sofer with us, his new book, Taking on Iran. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to Hoover Institution Fellow and Distinguished Scholar Abraham Sofer about recent developments in Iran and his new book, Taking on Iran, which outlines a strategy for dealing with Iran. Yesterday, Iran's leader told the United Nations General Assembly that his country is under threat from what he described as uncivilized Zionists, and he urged other leaders to confront the power centers that he said dominated weaker countries. Abe Sofer, again, is also a former legal advisor to the U.S. State Department and former judge in New York State. Let's go to your calls, and we'll begin with the caller from Palo Alto. Arthur, welcome.
Good morning. I'd like to know what Mr. Safair's take is on the question as whether the United States under the George W. Bush administration weakened herself with respect to Iraq, with respect to Iran by invading Iraq, and also during the Bush administration allowing North Korea to obtain a nuclear weapon?
Well, I think that attacking North Korea would have been a senseless thing to do. We weaken ourselves when we make threats that that we don't follow up on. The South Korean government made it very clear to us that they did not want us to attack North Korea. They have 5,000 artillery pieces aimed at Seoul, and would have killed 1 million people if we had attacked the North, or at least that was the expectation by all our military people. We knew that in advance. We shouldn't have made such verbal threats against North Korea when we have no plans to make such an attack. It's a very difficult and dangerous thing for North Korea to have any nuclear weapons, but there had to be other strategies short of that. And did the Bush administration do that? Well, I mean, I think the quotes are equally available from the Clinton administration about North Korea. I mean, there's a day when President Clinton was on the border between the North and South and said, turned to the North and said, you will never have a nuclear weapon. And that there were similar statements made in the Bush administration. I'm worried about the credibility of the United States when we go out there saying we're going to actually go to war with a country over their nuclear weapons, when the whole history of U.S. practice has been that we don't create a war. We don't go to a war. We don't, in effect, start a war in order to prevent a possible war over weaponry. And that is something that I think everyone needs to take into account. It may well be that this time is different from the other times, and it's so dangerous that the president will be forced to do something.
Well, you say in your book that war may be necessary but not inevitable, and it's preventive. And yeah. I think what you're arguing for essentially is containment. But the caller also asked about the invasion of Iraq and how much that weakened us.
Well, I think that the invasion of Iraq was completely necessary. That you were dealing with a Stalinist leader who had invaded several countries, who had killed over 1 million people, who had used weapons of mass destruction. The future.
Who was also our ally when he was at war with Iran.
Well, you can blame us for making miscalculations. I certainly think that was a miscalculation. I was always in favor of recognizing that he was the aggressor. And we have made it clear to Iran. We've even apologized to Iran for having supported him at that period. But the fact of the matter is that we didn't have to stay there and try to turn Iraq into a democracy. That was the notion that we owed stuff to Iraq because we got rid of Saddam Hussein is something that I just never accepted. And I think that the same thing is true of Afghanistan. I don't accept the idea.
We go to another caller. Ray, you're on forum. Good morning.
Yeah. I was just wondering, why are we so worried about Iran when all the neighboring countries have nuclear weapons? Pakistan, India, Israel, and Israel's never been inspected. Why are we so unfair to Iran?
The answer to that is very clear. First of all, a long history of utilizing terrorist groups and actually committing terrorist acts themselves through the IRGC shows that Iran is a much more aggressive entity. And the ideology of Iran is to drive the West out of the Middle East and very anti-Sunni and pro-Shia. They have intervened in many countries, including they've tried to intervene in Saudi Arabia. There have been many people killed as a result of some of these efforts that they've
made. Well, I think
made.
That's to the point, too. If you if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia and Egypt and other countries in the Sunni world are going to get an arms race on our hands.
And finally, the fact of the matter is that they, unlike any of these other states, they are actually saying that they want to destroy a member state of the U.N., and I mean, it may well be that the Iranians would never use a nuclear weapon against Israel. But It doesn't help their situation, and it doesn't help Israel be able to cope with the problem, and it doesn't help the United States be able to maintain stability in the area, to have a state openly saying, openly trying to get nuclear weapons, and openly saying they want to destroy a member state who happens to be an ally of ours. So, yeah, it is different from Pakistan. You don't have those kind of threats, even though Pakistan is India may be a much more dangerous situation in reality.
President Clinton said there's no more dangerous part of the world, and I guess he was really including the Middle East. No more dangerous part of the world than Pakistan and India right now in terms of nuclear confrontation or the possibility of nuclear confrontation. And let me get to another caller here, and that's Andrew. Andrew, you're on. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. You know, it seems like in this whole discussion, the drumbeat for war, the war games, the strategy, all those things work within the confines of what would be an effective strategy if you were to use might. But it seems as though the heart of the matter is Israel. And the U.S. has lost all credibility in terms of dealing with these Arab nations when it's made agreements with the Camp David Accords to broker a peace, a two-state solution. It seems to me like you would take all the ammunition away from Iran if you were to try and come up with a two-state solution with the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Well, it would be very good if we could have made some progress in the peace negotiations. I think the Cairo speech was a real setback for peace in the Middle East. When the president failed to distinguish between the settlements around Jerusalem and the other settlements and basically took a position that was even more impossible to implement than any position taken by the PA at that time.
There are some cynics who suggest that it's in Israel's best interest to keep, and the present administration of Netanyahu, to keep a lot of focus on Iran because of the settlements, because the settlements are moving forward, and President Obama wanted to do something to bring secession to the settlements moving forward, and now nobody's trying to bring that kind of influence.
Well, you got to hand it to George Bush for having convinced Sharon to give up Gaza and move this process along in a dramatic way. But look what happened. I mean, it's a complicated situation. The people in Gaza
Sending rockets into Israel.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that should have been handled better. And I fully support what Sharon was planning to do, namely a withdrawal from the other territories in the West Bank. But you can't make it impossible for the parties by saying there's no difference between the settlements right around Jerusalem and everything else when everyone had accepted that principle. And now the president has seen that doesn't work, and he's come out with a much more practical proposal, namely back to the exchange of territory after the 67 lines. And I think maybe in his second administration, if he has one, he will push that, and I certainly support it. I just don't think that is what's causing Iran to be the aggressor that it is.
There's a lot of predicting that if he has a second administration, he's going to push a lot harder because there is probably some enmity between the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu, or at least a discomfort with each other and a kind of jockeying that's going on that, you know, Netanyahu has been snubbed a couple times by the president. The president wanted to push back to the earlier borders, and there's a feeling of real discomfort there, it seems to me. And President Obama even, you know, said to Medvedev privately, well, wait till I have a second term. One can assume that there may be some push or greater push where Israel is concerned. But let me get to more calls here, and let me go to Oakland. And Peter, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having the show. It's certainly a timely and valuable topic. I'd be curious to hear the perspective from Mr. Sofer that, you know, there seems to be a consensus amongst national security professionals, both in the U.S. and in Israel, that a military action, first of all, wouldn't be successful, and second of all, would most likely be kind of counterproductive, and then it would encourage Iran to accelerate their nuclear program. So, you know, multiple former directors of Mossad, which is kind of the equivalent of the CIA, and Shin Bet, the equivalent of the FBI, and is Israel have taken this position in the U.S. You know, people from both parties, like CIA Director under Bush, Michael Hayden, Secretary Gates, you know, and a long list of people have said, you know, military action would make the situation worse. So what's your perspective in terms of containment, ultimately, and kind of the best way forward if you take military action is probably making, you know, taking things from bad to worse in a hurry?
Yeah, I think you say in your book, Abe, that if there were an attack, it would accelerate things and there would be greater solidarity among the Iranians. But there, you make this distinction between going after the IRGC, that is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, as opposed to going after nuclear facilities, which brings even more unity of Iranians. They don't want to be pushed on that level, but they don't care a lot. Many of them, I mean, I'm not only talking about Green Revolution people. Many in Iran have a good deal of contempt and enmity toward the Revolutionary Guard.
Exactly. I think they are very unpopular in Iran. They're regarded as, and properly so, as a very corrupt and powerful and oppressive group. And they've gained in power over the years as we have failed to check them and their activities. Because they say publicly in Iran, the Americans are not going to stop us. We can kill whoever we want anywhere in the world, and the Americans don't stop us. My effort here is
thinking
not,
about Bulgaria, for example, more recently.
My effort here is not to use force. That is not the point. The point is, what degree of strength can bring the Iranians to the table to negotiate in earnest? And what structure of diplomacy and diplomatic practices is more likely than what we're doing to bring about a peaceful resolution to this? The fact of the matter is, this is hard work. Dealing with the Soviet Union, for example, was hard work because you're dealing with a country, you're trying to convince that country to change its policies. I agree with what the caller said about Gates. I have a high regard for Gates. And he said very accurately, if we don't want an outright total war with Iran, the only way to solve this problem, in fact, even a war wouldn't necessarily solve the problem, but the only way to solve this problem is to convince Iran not to develop a nuclear weapon. How do you do that? Well, the first thing you do is you get their attention and show them that you're not going to let them kill Americans with impunity. Now, that's, you know, clearly that is risky somewhat, but it's a hell of a lot riskier than making a big war. And I've shown in my book that the four times we use strength, and the one time in particular we used strength with Iran, they responded positively diplomatically.
Well, we mentioned 1987 with the oil platforms. Yeah. You're talking about also driving Iraq out of Kuwait and after the driving out of the Taliban in Afghanistan and more recently after the Saddam regime fell in Iraq.
And people don't realize how intimately and effectively we negotiated with the Iranians at that point. Ambassador Jim Dobbins and others actually met with the Iranians and have written books and essays about how constructive the Iranians were in those negotiations. I think if we negotiated with the Iranians the way we did with the Soviets, with the practices that we applied with the Soviets, and with the strength that we responded to Soviet aggression, then we would have a chance of resolving this thing peacefully. And that's what my book is for. My book is not a war drum book. It's a book to try to create an alternative to this almost fatalistic sense we have that we're either going to have a massive war or Iran is going to have to be contained. And I am against containment. I think it's very dangerous. The containment option may be even more dangerous than a war. I don't know.
Well, that's what we did with the Soviets.
Yeah, it is what we did with the Soviets. But the Iranians are different. It's going to trigger a I think what the president said yesterday about how dangerous a nuclear armed Iran would be is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Now, that doesn't mean in the final analysis we won't have to opt for containment. It may well be that that's where we'll end up if we don't adopt some intermediate, practical, good old diplomacy that the U.S. strength plus diplomacy that the U.S. has used to its favor and in the past, and I found it in Congress when I was in the Reagan administration that we treated these two countries so differently, and I still find it in Congress.
Talking with Dr. Abraham Sofer, who was an advisor to the U.S. Department of State, now a distinguished scholar at the Hoover Institution, and his book is Taking on Iran. In fact, Secretary Schultz, George P. Schultz, for whom the chair that Abe Sofer has at the Hoover Institution is named, says the lawful use of defensive strength against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps could, in addition to deterring aggression, provide important diplomatic leverage. And that, it seems to me, is the key to what Abe Sofer is arguing. Let me get some more of your calls on here. Charles, join us. You're on. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I'm in full agreement with your guest, you know, because this involves religion. You know, I'll state I'm a Catholic. I believe without question that the Iranian government is illegitimate. You know, I'll never forget the scenes from the 2009 election. It's a government of thugs. That's my feeling. And diplomacy is not a word in their vocabulary. I don't know how, you know, we can go forward with that. But another question I had is, it seems like Russia welcomed this illegitimate government with open arms right from the get-go. And we've seen what Russia has done with Syria. And it seems like they've been, you know, capitalizing on trade with Iran, with arms and whatever else they can fend off there. What does your guest feel about Russia's involvement in making this thing more difficult than it needs to be?
I think Russia is playing a dangerous role, particularly in Syria but also in Iran directly. Iranian activity in Syria, it just shows how aggressive they are, and openly aggressive, and how willing they are to lie openly, publicly about what they're doing, and at the same time do exactly the opposite of what they say they're doing. They are in Syria. They are helping Assad do his murderous thing there, and we are going to be dragged into this for sure.
Dragged into Syria?
I only hope that we work with Turkey and the other countries around. We're certainly not going to be able to work with the Soviet Union. They have not been helpful on this issue.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails. Rick writes, the saddest part about Iran is that they have a very large population of rebellious youth whom the old religious zealots would be happy to sacrifice on the altar of their barbaric regime and its effort to control the Persian Gulf. Iranians should never be allowed to have an atomic bomb if we do not want to have one arrive in New York in the keel of a sailboat. And another listener writes, all this talk about sanctions and war is total nonsense. The real solution is nuclear-free Middle East, which is an idea supported by Iran. If you are against this, then you really don't want a solution. I didn't know that was an Iranian position. Here's Alan, who says, Mr. Sofer is the walking definition of chutzpah. The gall of this discredited neocon to expect anyone to give credence to anything he has to say after his despicable conduct in the run-up and prosecution of the war in Iraq is the very definition of chutzpah. He and his neocon allies should never be heard from again. Jonathan.
Well, I guess that's the question addressed to you, Michael. Why? What are you letting me on here for?
Well, no, actually, you already dissociated yourself from the neocon point of view.
Well, I did at that time. You've interviewed me many times about Iraq and Afghanistan, and I've said repeatedly that we should defend ourselves against our enemies that try to kill our people or succeed in killing our people, but we should not kid ourselves about what's doable in these interventions. I can't be blamed for projects that I was not involved in. I think that the Reagan administration did very well with the Soviet Union in defending America and bringing about freedom for a lot of people in the world. But on the other hand, we did very badly with Iran, very badly. We did not deal with Iranian aggression, and we did not negotiate effectively with Iran. And
Well, we've had all our debates about the Iraq War. They're all listenable in our archives, and
right.
You and I have locked horns on that. I don't want to necessarily open that box again, but let me go to some more of our emails here. Max writes, your guest said, we don't go after innocent people. Let's talk about a concrete thing. Here is a concrete thing that I would like to hear him talk about. Since Reagan bombed Libya, or even before, the majority of people killed in American actions against terrorists have been noncombatants. This is a fact. This fact inspires more terrorists. That's concrete. What is also concrete is that your guest ideas are somewhat pointless to discuss because Americans have tired of foreign wars. This book is 10 years out of date.
Well,
but what about the point, though, that, I mean, terrorists hit most noncombatants. This even inspires more. I mean, when America hits terrorists, they hit mostly noncombatants, collaborative damage, whatever. This inspires more terrorism.
Well, there is an empirical issue there. I am not in charge of that. I don't have any inside information about the number of noncombatants that are killed in these strikes, these limited strikes. But the government's position, and the president is a liberal Democrat, and he's been elected by the people, and he's surrounded by people who have a long history of humanitarian concerns and support. And they all say that it's not true, that these attacks are much more targeted. Their collateral damage is much less from these targeted attacks. And I have no reason not to believe them.
Here's Jim who writes, Mr. Sofair appears to be one of those tough guy warriors who is willing to take us into yet another endless war we can't afford. No one denies that Iran is a menace. I fail to understand why the U.S. should, once again, be the lead military force when Europe and Israel are the most threatened. Why do hawks throw away their rearview mirrors when they advocate for new U.S. aggression? Get some other opinions here on John Riley says, it's a question. You think that just maybe Iran's aggressive behavior is in some ways related to the United States' aggressive behavior? Really, who has been more aggressive?
Well, I certainly think that the efforts of the United States in Afghanistan was not a form of aggression whatsoever. The Security Council found that we had the right to defend ourselves as a result of the 9/11 attacks.
Staying on
in Afghanistan might have been a mistake in the sense that we have overreached in an effort to be helpful to the civilian population.
I said I wasn't going to open the Pandora's box about Iraq again, but we weren't attacked by Iraq.
We weren't attacked, but there were 16 resolutions and lots of findings made that Iraq was engaging in all sorts of international law violations. Iraq had invaded Kuwait, had attacked Saudi Arabia, had attacked Israel, had used chemical weapons against its own population and against the Iranians. I just think that people think that there's so much you can do in these kind of discussions. I certainly respect their views, but we're dealing with a president here who has said – he's a Democrat. I happen to be a Republican. He has said that he will do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. That's the issue we're facing.
He's saying this before an election, and
yeah.
I think that has to be kept sort of center here. I'm not trying to in any way cast any aspersions on President Obama, but he has – it's an election to win, and he has support that he has to get behind him. So and this is true for both candidates. They're saying what they feel certain audiences need to hear at this point. That's politics. Let me get another call.
Well, I understand that. But the fact of the matter is, Michael, that he is saying that he will use whatever force he needs to use to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. I am suggesting that there is a less extreme way of dealing with Iran that involves ultimately much more of a diplomatic effort. And while your readers might be reading what we're talking about as an increase in the use of force, it is an increase in the use of strength, much more limited strength than it would take to destroy a nuclear program. But on the other hand, it is a far greater and more dramatic increase in the use of diplomacy. And the purpose of this increased strength is to bring both states to the table the U.S. and Iran in a diplomatic engagement. Half my book is all about these five different practices that we use with the Soviets that were so effective and that we have not followed with Iran. And how do you bring Iran to the table? This is my suggestion as to what has worked in the past and what I believe will work in the future to bring Iran to the table for meaningful negotiations.
The book, again, is Taking on Iran. Let me get you on, Farhad, while we have a little time here. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, this is Farhad. I'm an Iranian-born U.S. citizen now. And wanted to see Mr. Sofer, although I've never had any opinion, high opinion of Hoover Institute, but nonetheless, Mr. Sofer, I have read his book, and I have to agree with many of his points. What I wanted to say was mainly most of the rhetoric that the Iranian government plays is for that small percentage of their own radical supporters. And I have been following this very closely. They need that support. The regime of mullahs, in my opinion, and I wanted to see what Mr. Sofer's opinion in that, they want to exist. They don't want to destroy themselves. They don't want to go away. In fact, that's the last thing on their mind. They want to have a lasting existence.
Farhad, excuse me, we're coming to the end of the program. I'd like to get Abe Sofer's quick response to what you're saying here. That a lot of this is for internal purposes, a lot of the rhetoric.
Yes, I agree with him completely. And I think that if we could face up to the IRGC, the internal mix will change. And we will not be alienating the young people who like America and our values.
Good note to end on. Abe Sofer, thank you for joining us. The book by Abe Sofer, again, is Taking on Iran. And we want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our interns are Bradley Davis, Reva Gold, Nora McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.